Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in partnership with McGraw-Hill Medical. Our hosts are Dr. Naveen Kumar, Dr. Walker Redd, Dr. Emily Gutowski, Dr. Joyce Au, and myself, Blake Smith. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is meant for informational and educational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances.
Welcome back to Run the List. My name is Emily Gutowski, and today we're continuing our nephrology series with Dr. Samira Farouk. She's a transplant nephrologist at Mount Sinai Hospital. She serves as Associate Professor of Medicine and Medical Education and Associate PD of the Nephrology Fellowship. She's passionate about medical education, has received multiple teaching awards, and she's the co-founder of NephSim, a popular online tool to learn about nephrology. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Farouk.
Thanks for having me, Emily. Really excited to be here.
So without further ado, let's go ahead and run the list. Today, our case is a 24-year-old woman who's presenting to the ED with 4 days of nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, and she's coming in because she hasn't been able to keep anything down, and she's feeling weak. Her vital signs show a blood pressure of 95 over 60 and a heart rate of 110. She's not on any medications, and initial labs are notable for a potassium of 2.6, low chloride, and high bicarb. So Dr. Farouk, first, how do we think about hypokalemia? What exactly is hypokalemia?
So this is an interesting case here with a patient that has significant hypokalemia. The normal range is somewhere between 3.5 and 5, and this patient is presenting with 2.6. So I'm going to share a general approach to electrolytes that isn't specific for hypokalemia, but what I think can really be helpful for any electrolyte disturbance. And this is going to really focus on, first, is this lab value real? And do we believe what the lab is telling us in the clinical context? The second is, what keeps this electrolyte normal? And by understanding that, we can approach number three, which is, what is the abnormality and can we reverse it? And if we can't reverse it, what can we do in the interim? And so let's focus on potassium. And we're not talking about hyperkalemia today, which is a more common arena where we talk about, is the lab value real? But also the same principles really apply for hypokalemia. And so there are several factors that can make the lab value inaccurate. And that starts with not only the type of tube that we're using, is there an anticoagulant present or not? How long has that tube been sitting out? Is it sitting on ice? Is it sitting on room air? All of that can really impact the amount of potassium that is going in or out of the cell. How difficult was the technique? Was there a tourniquet on for a long time? That can make potassium levels falsely elevated, as we can have what's called local hemolysis. And then finally, there's a rarer phenomenon called reverse pseudohyperkalemia, when plasma and serum potassium values can actually be higher or lower than each other because of movement of potassium in or out of the cells. And so the core of all of this is that 98% of potassium is actually intracellular. So one of the important things to think about is, there something causing potassium to shift in or out of the cell? So if we are confident that this was a accurate lab collection, this seems like it might fit in the clinical context, what's really important to think about is, what is it that is keeping potassium levels normal? And so as a nephrologist, we're thinking about lots of electrolyte disturbances quite often. And most electrolytes have one hormone that tends to regulate whether they stay in the normal range or not. So for example, for sodium, that's antidiuretic hormone. For calcium, that's intact parathyroid hormone. And for potassium, it's no surprise that that hormone is aldosterone. And so without going into first year physiology and what is happening at the tubular level, we can simplify this a bit and say that what you need to get rid of potassium and maintain normal potassium homeostasis is delivery of sodium to the distal nephron. You need aldosterone to be there and active. And then aldosterone will eventually lead to potassium secretion. So in the context of hypokalemia, one potential explanation could be that we have either over-delivery of sodium to the distal nephron, or we have overactivity of aldosterone. And the second thing that we think about with potassium, again, because of its mainly intracellular distribution, is that, is there something that is causing more shift of potassium inward? And so that means that I have less potassium now in the extracellular space and more that's going inside. And so one example of that is actually a treatment for acute severe hyperkalemia, which is insulin. So insulin acutely causes potassium to shift inward. And so normally we do that to benefit from that consequence and to transiently lower potassium, but this can actually cause hypokalemia.
That's great. So let's transition to next steps. What other workup would you want to do at this point for our patient?
So thinking about the differential for hypokalemia can be really helpful to look for any acid-base disorders that are present, and that can give us a lot of insight into the pathophysiology in that particular patient. And so for hypokalemia, the two acid-base disorders that we're looking for are either, one, a metabolic alkalosis or a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. And so let's walk through each of these one at a time. So let's start with the metabolic acidosis. And again, this is generally going to not have an anion gap. And so if we're thinking about hypokalemia in that context, and there is a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis that is present, then we really have only two options for what's causing hypokalemia. So the one option is going to be diarrhea. We know that diarrhea leads to loss of bicarbonate-rich GI fluids that leads to an anion gap metabolic acidosis. And the other option is the renal tubular acidosis. So in general, what that means is that the kidney has some challenge in handling bicarbonate, which leads to a metabolic acidosis, and that can be accompanied by hypokalemia in two particular RTAs or renal tubular acidoses. So one of these is the distal RTA, and the other one is the proximal RTA. So the way to differentiate those two is by looking at the clinical context, as well as the urine pH, which is really the most helpful. And so in a patient that has an RTA and a very high urine pH, and so that's over 5.5 or 6, we're talking about a type 1 or a distal RTA. And again, this is often accompanied by hypokalemia. And in contrast, a proximal RTA generally tends to have a bit of a lower pH. And in this setting, we have hypokalemia because of impaired reabsorption at the level of the proximal tubule. And so what is an easy way to differentiate between diarrhea and an RTA other than looking at clinical context? An interesting tool that we can use is actually the urine potassium. And so in patients that have a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis and are having diarrhea and hypokalemia, we expect that the kidney should be trying to hold on to as much potassium as it can. So urine potassium should be very low or less than 15. In a patient that has an RTA, the kidney is not responding appropriately to either acidosis or to potassium loss. So we expect higher urine potassium and the urine potassium of greater than 15. So if we flip over to the metabolic alkalosis side, and so that's going to be a patient with elevated serum pH, high bicarbonate, that's going to be a primary metabolic alkalosis. And so this mechanism I really like because it is really looking at overactivity of aldosterone. So in a patient with hypokalemia and metabolic alkalosis, the question is, where is that extra aldosterone coming from? And if we can understand why that is, we can try to shut that aldosterone off if we can. And so if we break it down that way, the differential becomes very easy because there's really only two ways that you can get extra aldosterone. One is from volume depletion. And so that we would call secondary hyperaldosteronism. And so that could be in a patient that's having vomiting, that has been on longstanding diuretics, that has rare syndromes like Bartter or Gittleman syndrome, which are essentially mimicking being on high dose longstanding diuretics. Or we could have elevated aldosterone from some other pathology that is independent of the normal mechanism of aldosterone that is being released in response to volume depletion that is being sensed. And so there's several things that can cause that. And some of that is now going to be diagnoses that would maybe involve a nephrology consult. But there are diagnoses that would lead to either elevated aldosterone independently. So an example of that would be an aldosterone secreting tumor, also called Kahn syndrome, where you have an adenoma in the adrenal gland. You could have bilateral adrenal hyperplasia, which leads to the adrenal gland, both of them producing more aldosterone. And then rare syndromes called apparent mineralocorticoid excess, when you don't actually have extra aldosterone, but you have a syndrome that mimics that. And so you may have heard of black licorice leading to hypertension, elevated what looks to be like aldosterone activity. And that's because of essentially overactivation of the mineralocorticoid receptor. Cushing syndrome can also lead to elevated aldosterone levels, as well as an interesting syndrome called Little syndrome, which is actually overactivation of the epithelial sodium channel, which is not really elevated aldosterone, but what the end target of aldosterone is, which is necessary for eventually potassium secretion. And so the take home again here is that if I have too much aldosterone, it's going to not only give me low potassium levels, but also a metabolic alkalosis. And a couple other causes that we sometimes see in the clinical setting, renal artery stenosis, that leads to elevated renin levels, which then lead to not only increased angiotensin 1 and 2, but ultimately aldosterone. And then a very rare tumor, but which physiologically makes sense here, which is the renin-secreting tumor, which is a tumor of the JG or juxtaglomerular apparatus. And so again, elevated renin levels, the extra renin that is around is going to go through the normal pathway, which is increasing angiotensin 1 to ultimately elevated levels of aldosterone that cannot be shut down, and that's going to lead to hypokalemia with a metabolic alkalosis that's also there. And so if we come back to the volume depletion side, you may have heard of, quote, chloride-sensitive metabolic alkalosis. And what does that really mean? That really means that somebody that has a metabolic alkalosis that is going to improve once you give that patient back volume, usually in the form of isotonic fluids. And so we say chloride-sensitive because in a patient that has volume depletion and you check their urine chloride, the low urine chloride can be an indication of low effective circulating volume. And again, this needs to be interpreted in parallel with your clinical assessment. And so for the patient that we're talking about here, we know the patient's having vomiting, so that could theoretically lead to volume depletion. There's also low blood pressure here. And so it's very plausible that the low volume state has led to elevated aldosterone levels and also now contributing to the hypokalemia and potentially metabolic alkalosis if that is present. And so if we check that urine chloride and the urine chloride is actually high, and I feel pretty confident that on physical exam and based on the clinical history that the patient is volume depleted, how can I explain that? And so then we can think about a few different diagnoses now. And so what can give us volume depletion and give us aldosterone from volume depletion, but I get a high urine chloride? And so I'm looking at either use of diuretics. So using loop diuretics in particular can impair how the kidney or the nephron is handling chloride. And so the chloride may be high in the urine, even though the effective circulating volume is low. And then Barter and Gitelman syndrome, which again mimic diuretics, they're very rare genetic disorders. Barter syndrome mimics somebody that's on a loop diuretic. Gitelman syndrome mimics somebody that is on a thiazide diuretic. And why do they get metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia? Again, because they're developing volume depletion and elevated aldosterone levels, which are leading to hypokalemia and then also this metabolic alkalosis.
Wow, that was a lot to think about. So when we see a low potassium, we really have to think about the whole clinical context, how the patient's presenting, their whole history, and their acid-base status to really get to the bottom of why this is happening. And some of the initial studies that could be helpful, depending on how they're presenting, are urine electrolytes as well as urine pH.
Yeah. And I would also say that if you have the metabolic acidosis present, to also take a look at the urine potassium.
That's right. Moving on to treatment, sounds like it really depends on what the underlying cause of the hypokalemia is. But just to start off, when we have a patient like this in the emergency room and we know that she needs potassium urgently, how would we think about repleting potassium? And then how would we think about treating the underlying disorders?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when patients have hypokalemia, and particularly when we're getting down to the mid 2 range, and some patients may even present with more severe hypokalemia under 2, they often require a lot of repletion. And that's because, again, potassium is intracellular. So as I start to replete, a lot of that is going to go intracellular. And so my serum or extracellular levels will still be low. And so just to give you an example, there was a case report that was published a few years ago, you know, walking through how to manage patients that present with severe hypokalemia. And this patient, I believe, had a potassium level of 1.6 or 1.7. And over a 24-hour period, to get to a potassium of 3.7, this patient required over 500 milliequivalents of both oral and intravenous potassium. Wow. And so the if there was a key take home about severe hypokalemia, it would be that patients require a lot of repletion, and not only repleting, but also rechecking lab values rather than maybe once every 24 hours. If it's very severe, maybe even every 8 hours, so you can really stay on top of the potassium that you're giving back. And so a question always comes up, how should I replete it? Should I give it orally or should I give it intravenously? And so there's some, I would say, maybe a myth that oral potassium repletion has better absorption than intravenous. And actually, just before we got on today, I was looking to see that what the data is for that, because that really was what I was taught. And there isn't really solid data that oral bioavailability is much better than intravenous. But from a patient care standpoint and from my experience, I found that if patients can take potassium orally, that is a great place to start. And a simple reason for that is that intravenous potassium burns. If you ever prescribed it to a patient, within a few seconds of that medication going in, it is a really, really uncomfortable experience. And so what my recommendation would be is to start orally if you have mild hypokalemia, something that's over 3. And if you're getting under that and the patient does have an IV, you can give simultaneous oral and intravenous repletion. And if the patient does have a central line, you can give a little bit more rapidly, and that may be a little bit less uncomfortable, but definitely would not abandon giving oral potassium if the patient has a bowel that is working and that they can essentially use. And so with a patient with a potassium of 2.6, my starting would probably be giving 40 orally, maybe giving 20 IV, and repeating the potassium in 8 to 12 hours.
Got it. Makes a lot of sense. Are there any other electrolytes that we should be looking out for while we're treating the hypokalemia?
Absolutely. And that's also a great question. So there's two in particular that I would look at. So the first one is actually sodium, which is not super intuitive. The reason for that is if somebody has severe hyponatremia, and it's a patient where you're really worried about potentially having an overcorrection and putting the patient at risk for osmotic demyelination syndrome, and they have concomitant hypokalemia, their risk of demyelination syndrome is actually higher. And if you give them potassium repletion, you actually will inadvertently also raise their serum sodium. And so the reason for that is the serum sodium is actually a reflection of your exchangeable sodium and your potassium. And so without going into the, you know, physiology behind that, the key here is if a patient has severe hyponatremia and severe hypokalemia, take a pause, discuss with your nephrology team to discuss what the best approach may be. It's not that the patient doesn't need potassium. Hypokalemia, of course, can put patients at risk for arrhythmia. But if you do need to give potassium back, then you need to kind of keep an extra eye on your sodium, or maybe hold off on whatever intervention you were maybe thinking of doing to raise the serum sodium. So that's the kind of, you know, what do we do to keep the patient safe? The second electrolyte to look at is the magnesium, and that is to improve your efficacy of potassium repletion. And so the mechanism behind that is actually pretty interesting. And so if you have magnesium deficiency, you actually have inhibition of a channel called ROM-K, which is responsible for potassium secretion. And so normally magnesium is able to inhibit that channel, and so you're preventing potassium from being excreted from the body. So with magnesium deficiency, you actually are going to lose that inhibition, and that's going to make you more susceptible to what we would call kidney potassium wasting. And so low magnesium alone probably is not going to give you low potassium levels, but if you have low magnesium and a condition that's going to predispose you to potassium loss, and you try to give potassium back and you have not repleted the magnesium, one way to think about it is that the potassium is going to come in and just come back out, because essentially the gate for potassium to exit is now wide open when you need it to be closed, so that the body can actually hold on to potassium. And so in summary, the two things to look at, and again, these are going to be available on the basic metabolic panel for the sodium, and the magnesium, unfortunately, has to be in most centers be checked separately, is to look at those two things first before you embark on a, you know, aggressive potassium repletion.
That's really interesting. I did not know that about magnesium, so thank you. So going back to our patient, she has a normal EKG to begin with. She is monitored very closely and repleted with oral and IV potassium until her potassium reaches a normal range. She's given IV fluids, and her diarrhea and vomiting gradually resolve, and she's discharged in 2 days feeling much better than when she came in. So Dr. Farouk, thinking about wrapping our case up with a couple of clinical pearls, what would you tell our listeners?
That's hard. There's so many. So where do we start? So I think pearl number one is that if you have a patient with hypokalemia, reflexively should be to look for, is there a concomitant acid-base disorder that's present? And if there is one present, really use that to guide your differential diagnosis. And so the two that we're thinking about are metabolic acidosis, and that should trigger us to think about diarrhea or renal tubular acidosis as a cause. And then on the flip side of that is metabolic alkalosis, and that should really trigger us to think about, what is a trigger for aldosterone release? Is it volume depletion or is it something else? I think a second pearl would be when we're thinking about repletion, to really look at not only the serum sodium to make sure that it's safe to replete potassium the way that we want to. And the second is to look at magnesium levels so that our potassium repletion will be effective. And we didn't really talk about the electrocardiogram changes. And I think another pearl is to not forget that hypokalemia can be as dangerous as hyperkalemia in leading to cardiac arrhythmias. And so the classic change that we talk about for hypokalemia is what we call a prominent U wave. And so the best way to describe that without showing you an image is that after the normal T wave, you get essentially what looks like another T wave. And in severe hypokalemia, that U wave may actually even look bigger than the T wave. So it kind of looks like there's two T waves after the QRS complex, and that U wave is going to look more prominent than the T wave. You can also get a slightly peaked P wave, and the PR interval can also be a little bit longer than the normal of 120 milliseconds. And the final pearl I would say is that really think about, what is the underlying pathophysiology of the hypokalemia? Because if you don't address what the underlying cause is, you may keep repleting potassium and you're kind of not going to get out of that loop. And so if the problem is high aldosterone, metabolic alkalosis also present, and that's because of volume depletion, you need to give not only potassium, but also isotonic volume to replete the intravascular space. If the problem is diarrhea and you have an appropriate kidney response, again, you can keep giving all the potassium in the world, but there also has to be an evaluation for, why is this patient having diarrhea? And some of the underlying causes we may not be able to treat, or at least not in the acute setting. So an example for that, say somebody has a distal type 1 renal tubular acidosis that can occur in the setting of autoimmune diseases like Sjogren syndrome. I'm not going to be able to overnight make that go away. And so in that patient, being aware of that and knowing that this patient is going to need a lot of repletion for us to keep up, because I cannot turn off the underlying mechanism overnight. I just want to add one more thing that I do often see on the inpatient side, and that's patients that have acute kidney injury or chronic kidney disease that are placed on a renal potassium restricted diet. And alongside of that, they're getting daily potassium repletion. So another place to look at is, can you liberalize the patient's diet to let them eat potassium rich foods?
Makes a lot of sense. I think we have all learned a lot from this episode, and our future patients who have low potassium will be treated much more thoughtfully. Thank you so much for your expertise, Dr. Farouk. It was great to have you on the show.